My beloved brethren and sisters, in the service of the Messiah of Israel, those of one common faith that have gathered together this day to remember our absent master and the emblems on the table before us. Prior to taking hold of these emblems, passing them from hand to hand and partaking of the spiritual values that they contain, we of necessity seek first to prepare our hearts and our minds to take them. And for this, of course, we turn to the Word for the very necessary words of exhortation. When we look through the pages of Scripture, we find that the Word itself is one great theme that runs right the way through it. We'll think more of this tonight in our lecture subject. We take hold of a book of the Scriptures, and again we find that there is a theme running straight away through that book. A chapter. And we can whittle it down until we come to the life of an individual within the orbit of that word. That in his life and the things that happen to him, the things that he does, the things that he says, there is a theme. And so it has been, has it not, in the days past when we have been looking at the life of Elijah the prophet. In the closing chapters of the first book of the Kings and the commencement of the second, as we saw in our readings of yesterday, there we have before us a theme that is worthy of note. It is a theme that takes us to the moment of time when we are brought out of the darkness of the present evil world to the light of the truth. And he goes on showing the various things that happen to us in our walk in the days of probation until the moment comes when, hopefully, we are received up into glory. We find these in various other places of the Scriptures. The opening chapters of the book of Proverbs reveals to us the life of a young man as he comes to the truth. As he follows the teaching of his father and he takes him through, it shows him the things that he expected of him. It shows the trials and the tribulations that are coming upon him to test him. And finally, having overcome all of these, he's taken to the crown of life, the jewel that will reveal his glory in time to come. And we get many little things like this. And here in this story or this narrative concerning Elijah, we get something very similar to that. If we stop to consider him, we see that we are contending here with a mighty force. We're contending here with one who is determined that the work given to him shall be accomplished. That the things that the Father has set him, that he will see them through. From the very start, of course, we get the exhortation, do we not, that the Father has given us a work to do. He has given us a work of preparing ourselves that we might be fit for his kingdom. He has given us the task of helping one another as we go along that road toward his kingdom and glory. And he has shown that beyond all this, that we have a responsibility for those who ask of us the faith that we hold so dear, to give to them the reason why it means so much to us, in the hope that the Father will look upon the seed that has been sown and give the increase. So here we're faced with one of the grandest and most romantic characters, I would think, that has ever been produced by the nation of Israel. A Tishbite, a sojourner in the land, a stranger, as it were. That's the meaning of Tishbite. And again, it takes us to ourselves, does it not? With having come to the truth, having come to a knowledge of the will of Yahweh and what he would have us do, that we immediately become strangers and pilgrims in the land, that we walk in his ways and not in the ways of those who are around us. That as far as possible, we ignore the things that go on around us and look to his will, to the spiritual values of his word, and so base our lives upon that word. So he have Elijah the Tishbite, who was of the inhabitants of Gilead, the hill of witness. And he truly comes forth to witness to the will of Yahweh, does he not? His name itself, as you well know, Yah is El. And he makes a dramatic appearance in the midst of Israel on behalf of Yahweh, his El. He comes to the people at a time when their sins are many, when following the usual pattern of the nations, of the nation, they have gone astray, they have followed their own willful ways, they have turned from him. And now he is about to reproach them, to show them that the ways they are walking in are wrong, and to show to them that there is a punishment to come if they do not behave themselves. And the effect that he has upon us as the servants of Yahweh are even more dramatic. We see here a man, a solitary character. We see a man of the deserts. We don't have to go very far, do we, to fit that to our own way of life. In some places we're not quite so much sojourners and strangers as we are in others. Here in Cornwall, you are strangers and you are sojourners. You are few. You have very few of the comforts of the truth. And yet, with the word that you possess, you are able to be strong. You are able to go forth in the strength of that word. Like all servants of Yahweh, he is as we should be. Very, very forcible in our denunciation of the evil that was in existence around him. And the very first verse of the 17th chapter, the first of the Kings, shows to us just how forceful a man he was. Elijah the Tishbite, who was of the inhabitants of Gilead, said unto Ahab, As Yahweh Elohim of Israel liveth, before whom I stand, there shall not be dew nor rain these years, but according to my word. It's wonderful, isn't it, to think that here is one who is prepared to stand before the ruler of the land to give precise details of what Yahweh's intentions are with those people. He could have been slain immediately by the wrath of the king, had the king so desired. Reminds us of Jeremiah the prophet, doesn't it? This young man who went to the king of that land and revealed the message and barely escaped the punishment of the king. He was hidden of Yahweh when the king sent to take him, to place him in the pit. A young man. Have you ever thought of that? Not only a young man in age, but a young man also in the things of the truth. What courage it must have taken for him to stand courageous before that king. He considered himself unworthy of the task. He says, No, I'm not. I can't do it. I'm young. It's impossible for me. But Yahweh says, You will do it. You will do it in my strength. And so he went forth in the strength of Yahweh. And so too here, we have this other character, this Elijah, who goes forth in the strength of Yahweh to make known the message that he had to give to the people. Out of the blue, Elijah appears with that message. First we hear of him in the pages of Scripture, no doubt it's not the first time that he's been heard of in Israel. It's the first that we hear of him, and he comes like a blast of wind upon the scene. And he must strike us with as much force as he did the people of his time. The utterance is very short in length, it's very full of meaning. Why was it given? Go back to the previous chapter, the 16th chapter, in verse 29. In the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, began Ahab the son of Omri to reign over Israel. And Ahab the son of Omri reigned over Israel in Samaria 22 years. And Ahab the son of Omri did evil in the sight of Yahweh above all that were before him. It came to pass that if it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, that he took to wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Zidonians, and went and served Baal and worshipped him, and reared up an altar of Baal in the house of Baal which he had built in Samaria, made a grove, and Ahab did more to provoke Yahweh Elohim of Israel to anger than all the kings of Israel that were before him. This is the reason why the message comes. Have you ever stopped to think this progression in apostasy? Each king that was an evil king, each of them, it is said, that he did more evil in the sight of Yahweh than those who had gone before him. Each one is getting worse. In other words, the apostasy is increasing in strength and is coming to the pinnacle of its power. And of course, it is at the pinnacle of its power that it is taken and destroyed. It's like the sins of the Canaanites that dwelt in the land. Their iniquity was not fulfilled until a certain time. And when that time came, they went. So we're immediately faced with two extreme opposites. Elijah, who was on Yahweh's side, who stood for correct service for Yahweh, a man who could not tolerate the presence of evil because his Elohim would not tolerate evil. It's a lesson to us, isn't it? When we see the evil around us, we don't mollycoddle it. We do our best to get rid of it. Then on the other hand, we have this evil combination, Ahab and Jezebel, the complete personification of all that is detestable in the sight of Yahweh. Lovers of Baal, their own sensual pleasures, rather than lovers of Yahweh. If you say we don't know anything about the earlier times of Elijah before this first verse, but perhaps for some time past he'd been affected by this evil combination, we can form a picture in our minds of the way his thoughts were running. Here was intense wickedness, and his sole desire was that the name of Yahweh should be exalted over this evil couple. Take that to our lives, in the ecclesia. We see that which is evil, that which is intolerable in the sight of Yahweh, being there in our midst. Our shackle should immediately rise against such of a thing, and we should take all the necessary steps to see that it is removed. Perhaps he prayed that Yahweh would show to the people how displeased he was with them. Perhaps he anticipated that it might be shown in some spectacular way. He's certainly acting on the principle that the prayer of a righteous man availeth much. James, in his 5th chapter, shows the truth of that principle. He says, Elias was a man subject to like passions as we are. He prayed earnestly that it might not rain, and it rained not on the earth by the space of 3 years and 6 months. And he prayed again, and the heavens gave rain, and the earth brought forth her fruit. Truly here was a man of faith. Here was one who was prepared to put his trust in Yahweh, to go to him for his help. See the little lessons that we can pick up as we go through this narrative. And having delivered the message, he proceeds to hide himself from Ahab in a deep valley east of the Jordan in which ran the brook Cherith. Brook Cherith simply means a trench. It means that which looks upon Jordan. We have the river Jordan flowing down, which is the river that runs from life to death. It starts in the north in the Sea of Galilee, where there is abundance of life. It flows down. Each wavelet as it comes down that river, acting in the part of a generation upon the face of the earth. And it flows on and on. Each generation passing on, they're going from life down to the Dead Sea. They're going down to death. And he's taken there to view this situation, to look upon the way of life as it was upon the earth, to see the way in which mankind was going, that but for the grace and mercy of Yahweh, they would all perish in the depths of that Dead Sea. After a while, the brook runs dry, and he's sent to the country, the very country that had produced Jezebel. He was sent to Zarephath in Zidon. Jezebel, ale sows. Zarephath, the place of refinement. And then we have Zidon, the fortress. Strange is it not that such an evil woman should play such a prominent part in such a message as this, that ale had sown the seed, that he had refined that seed as it grew, and when it had grown to perfection, he made it a fortress. That's what he's doing with us, is it not? He's sowing the seed in us, probably in some very unlikely places. Perhaps but for the word of a brother, chance remark maybe, we would still have been in the world from whence we came. But he has so much seed in our hearts. He has caused us to go through life. He is still causing us to go through life. And as we walk along that way, he is refining our characters. He's making us into characters that are pleasing to him. And when he has done that, we shall be part of that eternal fortress that he is planning for the earth and for those upon it who are faithful to him. And he goes in effect to say that for 3.5 years, 1,260 days, there is going to be no rain upon the earth. We've seen that, haven't we, in another sense. That for 1,260 years, the Catholic denomination has reigned supreme, and the word of Yahweh has been suppressed. We read too in this chapter, do we not, of the raising of the widow's son, and her acknowledgement that the prophet truly was a man of Yahweh. It teaches to us that there is resurrection for the Gentiles also. And Elijah was to show this trait in the days that were to come. He was to continue faithful to Yahweh, doing his work. In the third year, the drought was so intense that the king was forced to search for miles around for fodder for his horses and for his mules. Ahab, father's brother. Whose father's brother? He was not related to the things of Yahweh. Therefore, he must have been of his father, the devil. He must have been the descendant of the serpent's seed. And the word reveals that he was. And with this Ahab went Obadiah, the chief of the king's household. The servant of Yah went with Ahab, the father's brother. And so preparations were made in Samaria for the expedition. Samaria meaning to watch. They were to watch out for the rain. And Elijah was sent by Yahweh to meet Ahab at the same time, promising that rain was soon to come. We know the outcome of it, do we not? Chapter 18 and verse 1. Go show thyself unto Ahab, and I will send rain upon the earth. And he goes on to tell us of the encounter with Obadiah and with Ahab. And we're told that at the end of that time, the rain came upon the earth. And those who had despised the word of Yahweh in saying that the rain was to come were the very ones who perished. He goes on to speak of the encounter of the king of the prophet, the challenge on Mount Carmel, the fruitful place, Yahweh's prophet to the prophets of Baal, this issue and the coming of the rain, recorded in a narrative unsurpassed in dramatic splendour. What human being could write such as this with such feeling and with such truth in it? The opportunity given to the Baal worshippers to justify their claim, the failure of Baal to respond, the preparation of the broken Yahweh altar for worship, the added water, the intense prayers of the prophet, the burning of the sacrifice. Chapter 18, 38. The fire of Yahweh fell and consumed the burnt sacrifice and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and they said, Yahweh, he is the mighty one. Yahweh, he is the mighty one. And so the prophets of Baal are taken and they are slain. It's wonderful, isn't it? If you and I, brethren and sisters, we go through life contending with the evil that is around us. We think of the things that the world has to offer, the things they try to force upon us, and we reject them, I hope. And we think too of our life within the ecclesia, and we think of the things that brethren and sisters in various capacities in the truth would force upon us, things that would lead us away from the truth as we have it in Yahshua the Messiah. And we have these to contend with also. the sad thing is, in the case of Ahab and the priests, the evil priests, that they were part of the Ecclesia. They joined the Israel of Yahweh. They were, in effect, brethren and sisters who had strayed by reason of their greed, and they perished. The sad thing is to think that, although we may not feel so sad about the world outside us, the sad thing is that there will be many in the Ecclesias who also will perish, who have striven to bring false doctrine and false practices into the Ecclesias, endeavouring to lead many astray from the truth. So again, we see before us a man of Ahab. The law of Moses was in existence for Israel, and Elijah was determined that it should be kept. And it was by this keeping of the law, his relentless slaughter of the Baal prophets, that Elijah had aroused the fierce anger of Jezebel. And Jezebel was looking for reprisals. Elijah could face an angry king. An angry woman was a different matter. Angry woman he could and would not face. And so he departs into the wilderness. He may not have known it, but he was adopting a New Testament principle that the Master himself gave in his teaching of the people. And the Master himself had obtained it from Solomon. And the words of Solomon are, "It is better to be on the housetop alone than down in the house with an angry and contentious woman." And it was this principle that Elijah was following. He'd rather be many, many miles away. We know the true meaning of that, do we not? That we cannot study the word, we cannot give ourselves completely to the things of that word, if there is something else that is trying to draw us away. Something else that is hostile to the things in which we believe. And evidently he had much the same thought, because he goes into isolation. And just as many people have gone into isolation to get away from Roman Catholicism and have fled away from the evil of that teaching, so there must have been many who fled away from the teaching and the doctrines of Jezebel. And Elijah was one of them. And in isolation, in desperation, he wished that he could die. Was he just wishing to die to get out of the way? I think there's more to it than this. You and I particularly wouldn't wish to die, but it may be that the spiritual prompting to want the things of the kingdom might make us think that if we die now, we are spared further tribulation, and the next thing that we would know would be the things of the kingdom. Maybe, maybe not, but he thought this way, I wouldn't be dogmatic about it. But although he seemed to be alone, and although he was wishing to die, we know and he knew that Yahweh was with him. Yahweh, caring for his own, fed him and guided him through the wilderness 40 days and brought him to Horeb. And here, of course, he's standing in type for other events, the 40 years of travelling of Israel through the wilderness, the 40 years of Israel's return in the last days, as it was according to the days of the coming of out of Egypt. And many other 40s in the scriptures, the 40 days of temptation of the Master. They all play their part in this if we search through and find it. Here we've got the picture of the man who had done all that seemed possible to him, all that seemed possible to do in the service of Yahweh. How many times do we think that? Do we think that we've done our best, we can do no more? And yet Yahweh in effect says, get up. Go and do more. You can do it, and you can do it with my strength behind you. How often do we want to give up when by rights we should be continuing? We can imagine the thoughts that led him to desire for the death. Perhaps an echo of the words of the disciples of the Master, "I have forsaken all and followed thee. What is there left for me?" As the answer went to the disciples, "There's the kingdom. That's left for you." But as he say, chapter 19, verse 14, I have been very jealous for Yahweh Elohim of armies, because the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant. They have thrown down thine altars. They have slain thy prophets with the sword, and I only am left. They seek my life to take it away. How many times have we been in such a situation as this? When the things of the cares and the worries of the truth have weighed down upon us, and we feel it's impossible to go on any longer. They're even seeking after me to get rid of me. Perhaps they are. The exhortation is to go on. Here's a man with nothing left but a sense of loneliness and perilous of life. What's the cure? What is the cure that's offered to him? Verse 18. I have left me 7,000 of Israel, all the knees which have not bowed unto Baal, and every mouth which hath not kissed him. It doesn't mean that there were 7,000 faithful believers. There were simply 7,000 who had not bowed the knee to Baal. There were 7,000 who had not kissed him. They may not have had the truth, but they were opposers of that which was evil. The same way in which the two witnesses have worked right down through the ages. They may not have been saints in the accepted sense of the term, in which we believe that we have been called out, but they were saints as opposed to the things of the Roman Catholic organisation. Secondly, he's bidden to go back to that task that in despair he had abandoned, and accept the fact that the cause of Yahweh stands sure. And rebuked and yet encouraged, he returns to his duty, meeting his successor, the young man Elisha, on the way, the one whose life we are now beginning to read in that third chapter. Yahweh is Saviour. 2 years after this event, we read the incident of the vineyard of Naboth, the vineyard of prominence, in the 21st chapter. In this we find stressed by the king the difference between them. You look at verse 20. Ahab says to Elijah, hast thou found me, O mine enemy? And he answers, I have found thee, because thou hast sold thyself to work evil in the sight of Yahweh. This was the difference between these two people. One worked for him faithfully, the other one sold himself to do the exact opposite, to work evil before him. Mine enemy. Exact opposite the king. And this word, enemy, shows how great the difference was between them. Those who oppose us, we do not necessarily look upon them as enemies in the accepted sense of the term. But you know, in many ways, they are enemies. For the very simple reason that they are following practices and beliefs that are not in accordance with the divine will. We are not at one with them. And if we are not one up with them, if we do not believe the same thing, although then we may sit together in the same room, if we have not fellowship one with another, because fellowship is for us is based upon the things of the truth, and if the others have not the basis of the truth within them, we have no fellowship with them whatsoever. It may seem a sad and a hard thing to say, but nevertheless it is true. Now, looking at this, we begin to realise something more, something that should give us encouragement. Slowly but surely, Elijah is wearing the king down. He's beginning to wear him down. With an example here of a good man putting to shame the adversary. And this adversary had reached the extreme stage of rebellion against Yahweh. There seemed no hope whatsoever that he would ever conform to the divine will. Yet because of the continued testimony of the prophet, this is just what happened. It's a lesson to us. Look in same chapter, verse 22. He's told, I will make thine house like the house of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, like the house of Baasha, the son of Ahijah, for the provocation wherewith thou hast provoked me to anger and made Israel to sin. And Jezebel also, Yahweh spake Yahweh, saying, the dog shall eat by the eat Jezebel by the wall of Jezreel. Him that dieth of Ahab in the city, the dog shall eat, and him that dieth in the field shall the fowls of the air eat. So here we have the divine word. The word that was intended to be fulfilled. Nothing was going to stop it, or was there? On the other hand, we have the wicked one. Look at verse 25. There's none like unto Ahab, which did sell himself to work wickedness in the sight of Yahweh, whom Jezebel his wife stirred up. He did very abominably in following idols, according to all things as did the Amorites, whom Yahweh cast out before the children of Israel. You see what the end of it comes. When the judgment is given, the example of Elijah, the word of Yahweh came, verse 28, came to Elijah the Tishbite, saying, Seest thou how Ahab humbleth himself before me? Because he humbleth himself before me, I will not bring the evil in his days, but in his son's days will I bring evil upon this house. Here we got one. So evil, so vile in the sight of Yahweh, that the continual pressure from the prophet is causing him to humble himself. Humble himself, perhaps not to the extent that he will be saved and enter into the kingdom, but at least humble himself sufficiently to save the disaster coming in his day. His penitence postponed the judgment of his sins, but it did not cancel them out. You see, brethren and sisters, we say it's hopeless. Here is an example of one who may have thought it hopeless, but continued, and even though limited, success came. So he continues his testimony in the reign of Ahaziah, Ahab's son. He reproved him too for seeking after strange Elohim. Ahaziah's plan to arrest the prophets is frustrated by the calling of fire from heaven. We've got those three examples of the judgments that were to come upon the people. We see the real way in which one can be saved. Two had come saying, the king says, come down, come on, we've got to take you down. The third party went and bowed, humbled themselves before Elijah, and they were saved. And while he was visiting the school of the prophets at Bethel in Jericho, it's made known to him that his earthly ministry was about to end. And end it did in the manner as spectacular as had been his introduction to the work and the work that he had completed. Yesterday's reading, chapter 2 of the second book of Kings, verse 11. Came to pass, as they still went on and talked, that behold, there appeared a chariot of fire and horses of fire, parted them both asunder, and Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. And Elisha saw it, and he cried, my father, the chariot of Israel and the horsemen thereof. Saw him no more, and took hold of his own clothes, and rent them in two pieces. What a fitting way for one to end his ministry. Elijah there with the school of the prophets, showing to them what they should have been. A lifetime of service to Yahweh ended to be crowned with glory and with honor. For what was seen by Elisha was a picture of the final redemption of Elijah. Perhaps the word picture doesn't convey the right idea. It's more than the picture. It's a living testimony to the reward of a just man and a faithful servant. You notice that there are the two things here. He's taken away by the chariot of Israel, the spiritual conveyance of Yahweh's servants, probably the conveyance that will be used in the day to come when the saints are transported from one part of the heaven to the other to perform the Father's will in the kingdom era. And they also have the horsemen, the Elohim who guard the people of Yahweh. They had come to fetch them. They were the ones who transported him in the divine transportation to take him, as it were, into glory. The Apostle Paul saw this as a crown of righteousness laid up for himself in the presence of Yahweh, also for those who loved his appearing. The Apostle John saw it as the visitation to earth of the New Jerusalem. Isaiah saw it as the ransomed of Yahweh entering the gates of Jerusalem with joy in their heart and with a song upon their lips. Jeremiah visualized it as the deeds of a property in Anathoth, resting secure till the day of recompense should come. Peter would remember it as the Master in glory, accompanied by Moses and by Elijah. But before Elisha, all through the days of his witnessing, would be this vision of the chariots of Israel and the horsemen thereof. The means of spirit conveyance for those who are called to be saints. The seraphim or heavenly transport by which everything were moved. Can we not say that these same seraphim, these same chariots and same horsemen were put into operation when the Master ascended to the Father in heaven? The right eye for the majesty in the heavens, although they were not visible to mortal eyes. And the horsemen, just as those depicted in apocalyptic writings, the guardians of those who undergo those journeys. My Father, a vision of the glorious saint body, a vision of the Yahweh Elohim, the new Israel. And above all else, it depicts the life lived by Elijah, that it will eventually be crowned with glory and immortality. Faithful life, a faithful service, a faithful reward for his labours. Every part of the character of Elijah is marked by a moral grandeur which is heightened by the obscurity thrown around his connections and his private life. His appearances are sudden and he seems to emanate from nowhere. His avowed intention to declare the commands of heaven and to instill awe into kings by his menacing and fearful judgments. His boldness, his loyal zeal for the honour of Yahweh sets the seal of Yahweh upon him. His austerity, his way of life, are the characters of the man of Yahweh, called to combat the spread of idolatry in that age, to demonstrate the might and the power of Yahweh, to reclaim or punish those who were astray from Yahweh. He rose in the land as a fire, his word burned as a torch, and both of these were unquenchable. How do we compare with such a great man as this? However we may compare, surely the exhortation is to be like him, for he pleased the Father by his faithful work. Wherever we see evil, the word of testimony against it must be produced from our lips. We must ever strive against principalities and powers. And I say a little earlier on, including the principalities and powers of the ecclesia itself if necessary. And when we feel faint, when we think that we're on to a losing battle, when we feel there's only a few of us left, as we oft times do, when we feel all alone in the world of apathy, let us remember the example of Ezekiel. Let's go finally to Romans chapter 11. Verse 2. Yahweh hath not cast away his people which he foreknew. Wot ye not what the scripture saith of Elijah, how he maketh intercession to Yahweh against Israel, saying, Yahweh, thou hast killed thy prophets, thou hast digged down thine altars, and I am left alone, and they seek my life. What saith the answer of Yahweh unto him? I have reserved to myself 7,000 men, and not bowed the knee to the image of Baal. Even so, then, at this present time, also there is a remnant according to the election of grace. What better place is there for us to commence our testimony against the decline of fervour for the things of Yahweh than in the household itself? And when we do, before us let the vision shine of the chariots of Israel and the horsemen thereof. Elijah performed 8 major miracles, 8 signs. The Master at his first coming also performed 8 major miracles. Elisha, when he came onto the scene, performed 16. Which means, of course, that he had the double power of the Spirit. We've seen when he donned the mantle of Elijah. And Master himself, when he comes again, he too will have a double portion of the Spirit in order to fulfill the work that is to come. Elijah spoke of Yah is strength. Strength, nay, in order that we might combat and overcome. Elisha means ale is salvation. He speaks of the future. And he shows to us that before us, if we follow the example laid down for us, for us also, there will be a life of glory. For the chariots of Israel and the horsemen thereof will come for us. And if we have been faithful, they will take us to glory. May it even be so.